Hey everyone, this is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today's guest is Yahya Jatha-Fanousi. You may already be familiar with him as we have published him in the Journal of Free Black Thought, but we also published his thoughts on the movie Do the Right Thing as a bonus podcast back in December of last year. Yahya is a former CIA analyst and an expert on national security and financial technology. He's the creator and producer of the spy podcast series, The Jabari Lincoln Files, featuring a protagonist who is an African-American Muslim CIA officer. In this episode, we talk about his Muslim faith to include what has happened post-October 7th. Of course, he tells us about his Thriller podcast, and we discuss why we should use African-American instead of Black. Because remember, there is no such thing as the Black African-American perspective, just African-Americans with perspectives.
Yahya, thanks for joining me today. You are certainly something special. I feel like you're the type of guy who enters a room and the average IQ goes up like 10 points. There are so many directions we could take this podcast today. We could talk intelligence and national security, your former CIA, and that's very relevant right now. We could talk crypto. You have a spy thriller podcast we could and are going to talk about. I mean, you have like a crazy resume that is really diverse. You have a lot of different interests, yet they're all intertwined. So we'll talk about that. And to be honest, there's one more part of your identity that wasn't even something that we were going to talk about when we knew when we started the Free Black Thought podcast that we would have you on eventually. And we didn't necessarily predict or know or foresee that we would talk about your religious background and that you're a Black Muslim man in America. And now that seems to be very relevant as well, and something interesting and a different lens that you bring, especially compared to a lot of the guests that we've had on the show recently in terms of what's going on in Israel, geopolitics, all that kind of stuff. So there's just so much good stuff, and we're going to try to touch on all of it. But as we always do with our first-time guests, please just tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? How were you raised? And how did your path kind of lead you to where you're at here today?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Connie. Really appreciate the time. I've been a fan of Free Black Thought since you all started, just as a journal, email, Twitter, and now seeing the podcast. Really happy to contribute and have this conversation. Well, I guess to get into my origin story, maybe I would break it down into a few phases. But in terms of my roots, I was born and raised in California. My mother is African American, mostly raised in the Los Angeles area. My father is from Sierra Leone, and he came to the United States in the late 60s for college. So he was coming out of, this was sort of when Sierra Leone was newly independent. He came, landed in on the West Coast, went to the University of Oregon in the late 60s. This was the time when the Panthers were, but they then met, I think, in UCLA. And I was born and raised there. I have a sister who's about 8 years or so younger than me. And so I grew up in the Los Angeles area with a few different phases. I mean, actually, my early days, we were in Oakland in the Bay Area. And then we went to Nigeria for a year. So when I was in second grade, my dad had to go back to, he'd finished his degree. He went back to teach. And he went to Nigeria. He couldn't go back to Sierra Leone, so he went to Nigeria. So we were in northern Nigeria for a year, my mom, my dad, and myself. My mom then got pregnant with my sister, so we came back to LA, moved with my grandmother, while my dad sort of stayed back for another year. So I was exposed to Africa in a very real way for that year, going to second grade, came back to Southern California. And that was, that first phase of my life was just probably your typical, young guy. And we lived briefly in South Central. Then we moved out to the Valley, moved out to the San Fernando Valley. And that's probably where I'd say my real roots are, because that's where I really came of age. And this was in the late 80s, early 90s. As a teenager, I was really influenced by the music, hip hop culture of the time. Do the Right Thing was a movie that sort of shaped my early life, as you can imagine. And so that was my experience. So that was, I think, the first phase. And then I went to college. I went to UC Berkeley. So, upstate in California, up in the Bay Area. And then, I think that was where all these different phases or these parts of my life came together, because I studied economics. I was really interested in development, international development, Africa. I traveled to the Caribbean while I was there for some school work. I did some research in Zimbabwe when I was, in my college years. So just very, very global. But then the thing that defined my college experience was towards the end of it, I actually sort of had a religious transformation. I probably should have mentioned, in terms of my religious background, my dad was not very religious. My mother was, came from a Christian family and was Christian. But I would say my upbringing was sort of, going to church sometimes, Christmas, et cetera. So not a strong background, but, mm-hmm. nominally Christian, I guess I would say. And so, it's a longer story how I kind of, found my way to Islam. But that was huge, right? Because that sort of, I think, changed my focus. A lot of the political and cultural focus that I had shifted, and I started thinking more about universal principles and like universal ideals, as opposed to the very sort of politicized, black power, black nationalist mentality that I had in my teenage years. And then to bring it to today, I guess the next phase was becoming an adult, going to grad school, getting married. My wife and I have been married for 23 years. Thankfully, she's still with me, and she hasn't gotten rid of me. And then my professional life, I went from getting a master's in international affairs to teaching for a few years in Washington, D.C., and eventually joining the CIA. Mm-hmm. so I joined the CIA back in 2005, and I worked there for 7 years. I was an economic analyst and a counterterrorism analyst. And I left government over a decade ago, but that was, that was just a seminal part of my life. I still am in the sort of national security space, not in government, but I've sort of followed a lot of national security issues. And even though I'm outside of government now, so that's kind of always on my antenna. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of a breakdown.
Yeah, that was a really good roundup there. What did your family think when you converted to Islam, especially your Christian mom? Yeah. Did she have hard feelings about that?
I had, a lot of converts will have this, hard sort of family breakup story. I didn't experience that. I experienced my mother, I don't want to give too much of her business, but, yeah. But I mean, I would say that she was very open to me and very respectful and accepting. And my Christian family, I mean, I was more close to my mom's family than my dad's, because my dad, most of the family was not here wasn't in California. So I would only say there were some maybe awkward things. I mean, becoming Muslim is a big sort of shift in your lifestyle in many ways. Not a huge shift, but I mean, just some of the sort of daily things, not eating pork, et cetera. And so there might've been some awkward things, because this was right when I was graduating. And so, I remember I had one of my close cousins, he was visiting me right after I had converted. And I remember I told him, this is a younger cousin. And I told him, I converted to Islam. And he was like, oh, what? You? No, no, no. And, I think I showed him like the Quran, and he was like, no, no, that's not the Bible. So there was a little bit of, there was a little bit of awkwardness, but thankfully, I graduated. My family came up to graduation, and they saw my life. One of the biggest examples, I think, of how I dealt with that was that, when I got married, I actually, my wife, who is Muslim, so my wife is also African-American, also Muslim, but not a convert. She was born and raised Muslim, and her parents, African-American, they actually came to Islam through the Nation of Islam. And then 1975, when Elijah Muhammad passed, and then his son sort of became the leader of that community and took the community to universal Islam. They were part of that. So she was in, the Boston area, very dynamic. The African-American community, Muslim community was very strong. And so when we got married in Boston, my family, my Christian family came to the wedding, and they met the family, and it wasn't antagonistic. I think they saw that we were open, that they were open, the family was open, and I think there was a bit of a bridge. So fortunately, outside of a few awkward issues, it hasn't been a problem.
Yeah, that's great to hear. You don't want to see families get torn apart for really any reason. So it's encouraging to hear that it wasn't too big of a struggle for you. And by the time we published this episode of the podcast, We will have long ago published your piece for the Journal of Free Black Thought titled "Do Not Let the Middle East Militancy Hijack Our Religion." Mm. I encourage everyone to check that out if you haven't already. But for those who haven't read it yet, I'll just say that that piece you wrote is not actually so much about your personal experience as a Black Muslim or any sort of advice as to what should Israel do and what should Palestine do. Yeah. It's really kind of a warning call against radicalization, and you're sort of talking more towards your Muslim brethren, but it's actually applicable to anybody on any side. So because that piece that you wrote, which is wonderful, doesn't really get into your personal experience, mm. I want to ask you, how has your experience as a Black American Muslim man changed or not changed pre or post October 7th? Like, has there been any awkwardness after the fact? Have people expected you to come out strong with, you know, big opinions and writing articles? What has that been like?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say so. It hasn't changed for me. My experience hasn't changed in any way. I think, these things, you know, this is a big geopolitical thing happening right now. But I mean, you know, at my age, you know, I've seen a lot of things happen. So it hasn't. I mean, maybe for someone else who might be new to the religion, but not so much. The piece was really more an observation of me seeing, I guess, things happening around me that through my vantage point are concerning, that don't really get voiced or aren't getting voiced in the social climate within the Muslim community. And I knew that I had some thoughts that maybe some people wouldn't agree with, but I felt like I had to say them. And I'll actually say, this might actually help for listeners to contextualize this piece, because even though this is not a perfect analogy, but this is somewhat, I was feeling something similar to what I felt in the summer of 2020 with George mm-hmm. Floyd, the killing of George mm-hmm. Floyd.
I was going to ask about that, actually, the parallels. I'm glad you're going there.
Yeah, because what it is, you know, and again, not perfect, you know, analogies, very different situations. One is an ongoing war that is still happening, right? But in the sense of with George Floyd, after, you know, I saw a lot of things happening after you know, George Floyd and the riots, which was that there was this one-dimensional narrative that was just permeating the culture. And I found troubling, because in it was like a sense of victimhood and victimization that just seemed to permeate and infect everything. And that was my take. And there were certain things that happened that I just said, oh no, this is not good. I mean, I understand why there's a lot of emotion around what happened, but how it's manifesting in terms of how people are reacting, this is not good for our culture. This is not good for the African-American culture. It's not good for American culture. And so, you know, I wrote this piece for 1776 Unites called "Black is the New Idol" in like late summer 2020. And so how is this similar? Well, there, you know, what has concerned me is that with this very volatile situation, you know, the Hamas attacks on Israel on October 7th, which was, you know, very, I mean, horrific attacks. And then, of course, it just sort of, you know, became the big thing on social media. Everyone had an opinion about it, and just becomes this controversial thing, this backlash back and forth. And then, of course, with, you know, the response from Israel, the humanitarian issues and disasters and deaths of civilian casualties, all of that. So it's very much in the public consciousness. But my concern is that, well, there's sort of two things. It's that, one, I also see, because this is such a volatile issue, like with George Floyd, within the Muslim community, there's like this one-dimensional political and activist narrative that seems to be permeating the culture. And that narrative, which again is sort of driven by, like, so looking at something, again, I'm not an Israel-Palestinian conflict expert, right? That's not my thing. It's not what I did mm-hmm. when I was in government, even though I dealt with terrorism and national security. But I, you know, never really dealt with that issue. It's not my issue per se to be an expert on. But what mm-hmm. I do feel like I understand, because as a counterterrorism analyst, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at movements around the world, the jihadist movement, and its arguments, how it radicalizes, how different organizations like Al-Qaeda would recruit, and the narratives that back in the day, this is during when Osama bin Laden was alive, the narratives that he would use, that Al-Qaeda used, the London bombers of July 7th, etc. And that a lot of the argumentation that they had, I see reflected in some of the argumentation around this conflict. And that's why it's a concern. So it's not that I'm, you know, trying to, you know, counter Palestinian rights or anything like that. It's just this concern that, hey, there's this undercurrent of radicalization that is, I think, exploiting the conflict. And I wanted to sort of flag that, because I think if people don't understand that, it could have bad consequences for the Muslim community in America, which is my main concern.
Mm-hmm. There's obviously a decent and growing population of American Muslims, but for a lot of people, they may not have interacted. They might not have a single Muslim friend. You know, they may not have, any mosques in their neighborhoods or anything like that. Mm. So when people are meeting you and they're not super familiar with your faith, and, you know, just like Christianity, right? There's many different sects. Yeah. There's many different, you know, theologies with under that Christian umbrella. Do you find that people tend to lump you into this sort of, they sort of assume like, oh, you maybe flirt with these radical ideas, or are people able to completely separate you? And they understand like you're an American, these folks are halfway across the world, you know, just in your personal conversations, or are people just scared to, I can see people just being kind of like, nice to meet you. How am I supposed to talk to you? I don't know how to handle this.
I don't think I have, nothing stands out as being, in my life, right? Because again, I've been Muslim for so long. I don't feel like I deal with anything outright, you know, like apprehension or anything. I'm sure though, just being people and human beings, yeah, people have certain, they probably have certain prejudgments, prejudices, maybe certain, ideas about Islam from whatever, what stuff they've read, stuff they see. And I'm sure that may impact them, but it hasn't for the most part impacted me in a way where I felt like, you know, oh man, my life is so tough or hard or anything like that. Plus, I'm me, I'm an American, right? I'm like me becoming Muslim didn't change my ability to interact with people and my personality, et cetera. So I don't think that people, I don't think it has been a huge impediment for me. I think the thing that I would say though, is that, in what probably people don't understand is that, because you're right, people don't interact with a lot of Muslims. So I think a lot of people have this idea that Islam is such a foreign thing. And I think maybe that impacts me. Like people see certain things and they're like, yeah, this Muslim thing is such a foreign thing. When you're in the Muslim community in America, the Muslim American community, the way I see it, Islam is very American. And in fact, you know, I credit my wife in a lot of ways, because my wife, she's a historian. She studied, her specialty is actually the history of Islam in America. Like that's her thing. So, you know, I know a lot about the roots, like the interesting way that Islam has played a part in the United States for a long time. So I haven't had that issue. Maybe the one thing that does come up that I should mention is, so here's the thing, because, you know, I said, my wife came, her family came through the Nation of Islam. So here's the biggest thing that I think most people don't get as an African-American Muslim. And just a little asterisk, because some people might say, why does he always say that? So I prefer, I know this might go into your speed round of questions. I'm going to answer.
Black or African-American.
Yeah, I use African-American. That's my preference. And I know sometimes I have this little debate with Charles Love about Black or African, because I'm like African-American for me. And I know I'm on Free Black Thought. So it's not like it's not that I don't use Black or I can't say Black or anything like that. But to me, African-American is, I think a problem with our language about race is the fact that we focus on color. And so how do we get out of a color-based mindset if we're always saying, oh, that Black person, that white person? Right. African American, even Caucasian, right? Which is not, people don't say, but it's hard to use it as an epithet, I think. Like you think about it, say that white man, that Caucasian man, you know, that Black man, that African American man, you know, it rolls off differently, right? And so getting away from color, even though African American is not the best, you know, some would say it's not the best. It doesn't really represent. There's no way you can categorize race that's going to be perfect. It's all going to be imperfect. So for me, I really prefer African-American. But a lot of people think if you're an African-American and Muslim, or a Black, if you're Black and Muslim, they think, oh, Nation of Islam. And I think a lot of us African-American Muslims get that. What people don't realize is that, if I can just give like a quick little history lesson, because this actually relates to my my identity. So what most people, like, everyone thinks about the nation from like how it got a lot of focus in the 80s and 90s, you know, during, I mean, because of Louis Farrakhan. And so what I was surprised when I sort of became Muslim was that history of the Nation of Islam, which it had different segments, right? You have the early days, 1930, then you have sort of when it grew because of Malcolm X in the 50s and 60s, and then, you know, Malcolm X was killed, and then you have this era that went to 1975. Elijah Muhammad died in 75, and his son, Wallace Muhammad, took, you know, became the leader. Most people don't realize that most of those people that were in the nation with that very sort of racial black superiority, you know, narrative and ideology left that, or it's not as they left that. And then they sort of, they embraced, because Wallace Muhammad, W.D. Muhammad, brought a universal understanding of Islam to that population. And it wasn't until later that Farrakhan, a couple of years later, said, you know what? No, I'm not with this thing. You're saying the white man's not the devil. Like, and he restarted the Nation of Islam under that old framework and mindset. But most of the followers went into mainstream and universal Islam, Islam proper, as I would say. And the funny thing is, most people thought the Nation of Islam was the bigger thing, when really it was that the bigger population was the African-American Muslims who identified with universal Islam.
What's the feeling amongst the African-American Muslim community about this BLM's like comparison to the Palestinian struggle? Are people appreciating those comparisons? Are they rejecting them? Or is it kind of split? What's the tone there?
I don't know yet. We'll see how people respond to the article, which I know is going to be controversial, because it's the same thing with the summer of 2020, which is, there is like this narrative. I feel like even within the African American community. So here's the funny thing, which is, it's funny watching the activism on this issue, you know, sort of the Palestinian issue, which often tries to draw comparisons to the African-American experience.
Exactly.
Because you'll hear that. You hear that in speeches like, and the black people did, you know, about the apartheid, et cetera, like drawing these comparisons. And I often find that those comparisons they're not apt. They're not, you know, you can point to obviously oppression. And so there may be some, you know, some commonalities there, but I almost feel like that's actually undermining what the African American experience was, even the South African experience, because you'd have to ask, where's the transformational leadership, that universal leadership that's bringing, you know, the people on all sides to an understanding of their brotherhood, and you know, what's the framework that's allowing these people in this conflict to work together, to grow together? Like, what is it? Or is it just activism on grievances? Because that's not going to get what the African-American, that's not how the African-American sort of achieve, right? There was a whole framework within our country. So, I mean, again, very different issues, but I would say that whether the African-American Muslim or just the other, Muslim, regular Muslims in America, you know, or not regular, but, you know, non-black Muslims in America, the image of foreign policy is just very one-dimensional. I mean, so people, I think, have this sense, I would say, of a like colonial, post-colonial mindset when it comes to international affairs. That's what I would say. I would say that the foreign policy, I don't want to say IQ, but the foreign policy understanding of the Muslim American community needs some maturation. It needs to mature. A lot of what I would hear, and again, this is just, you know, talking to just regular folks, friends, you know, colleagues, you know, it's almost as if, you know, we were in 1964, you know, in the middle of the independence movements, and thinking about, you know, Egyptian, you know, British in Egypt, and, you know, and the Belgium and the Congo, and like that mindset, which again, my father came over post independence, right? That mindset seems to animate how people see foreign policy, America in general, for many people, especially in this time, when there's a conflict, when it's, you know, Israel. I mean, I think that's the challenge, that the perception of foreign policy is just so one-dimensional.
And obviously you can like you said, you were in the CIA, you left, now you're still kind of doing a lot of this thinking about foreign policy and all that sort of thing. Why did you leave the CIA? It's so sexy, right? To say that you're in the CIA.
Yeah.
Why did you step away? Are the three-letter agencies really a big bureaucratic mess like many on the right like to claim? Or
yeah.
What, were you just ready for something new?
No. It's not a spoiler, but it's something I haven't talked. I've talked about this a little bit because I have to be honest. So it's so funny because my time at the CIA was, surprise, actually like highlight of my professional experience. I had, I really enjoyed it. I mean, government jobs, bureaucracies, I mean, all right, there are issues there. But in terms of the work, doing something meaningful, as a counterterrorism analyst, feeling like I was doing something, again, meaningful, helping my country, being a resource with the proper, hopefully, understanding of Islam to work on these issues that maybe some people didn't have. They didn't have that cultural familiarity with Islam, with the religion, with the references, with the scripture. All of that was great for the most part. I left, honestly, because I did have some problems. I did have some problems towards the end of my career where, I'll put it like this, because, someone told me, no, they didn't tell me, but I heard someone say about marriage, and I'm gonna liken leaving the CIA is like getting a divorce. And I remember someone said, not about the CIA, but about divorce, that once you have a divorce and you're able to talk about the separation and focus on yourself, that's when you've gotten past a bad divorce and not about the other person. So I'm going to talk about myself very honestly, hopefully. So I actually had a situation in, like I would say, a regular administrative review where I had, or my sort of security clearance review that everyone goes through every few years, I had made a mistake, an administrative mistake, and it wasn't, at least I didn't think at the time, anything big or controversial. It wasn't anything that would, be on the New York Times or anything like that, right? So don't no one's imagination think, oh my God, this guy, he stole secret, he leaked, to the Russians, nothing like that. But some things, these processes, there's a lot of scrutiny in general. And I made a mistake on something, and then found myself in a situation where I was under a lot of scrutiny just in general. And, some would look at my situation, point to, well, was there a religious angle or issue? There may have been, but I didn't really go that route. I just kind of stuck to my guns, and I was like, look, hey, I'm not in the wrong here. And, I defend myself up to the utmost. And I'm not going to, say that I did anything wrong, essentially, I think, through much of that time. And the security clearance process went really wrong to the point where I wasn't able to stay. I did not stay. And so I actually left at the height of my time there, really generally enjoying the work, but having some difficulties that when I talk about it, I don't talk about it, to tell people, oh, you know what? Oh man, if you're a Muslim, don't go here. If I have a personal conversation with someone, I'll say, great place to work. Really enjoyed it. I recommend people do it. Here's what you need to know about just the logistical issues and, things that you have to deal with working in that type of environment. It's not, it's not all, cake and sunshine. But I left, but even though I left a decade ago, I've been out since 2012, I have still been involved in the national security space in general.
Mm-hmm. I would actually think that kind of to your point about being able to educate people about Muslim culture and scripture and all that sort of thing, that there would actually, like the CIA would actually seek out intelligent, patriotic Muslim Americans for these, solving these problems in the Middle East specifically, but in other places, Northern Africa, wherever it's necessary. Was that the case, or was not so much, or was it mostly working with people locally, kind of contractor type of stuff?
So I was an analyst, to be clear. So, mainly at headquarters for most of my time. I was assigned actually to the National Counterterrorism Center, which is like a multi-agency, separate agency with different analysts from different agencies together. But what most people probably don't know is there are lots of Muslims within the CIA, within the intelligence community. Yeah. So it wasn't rare per se, right? Obviously, like not a majority or anything like that. But but I remember the first time during my interview, and this is probably what you know, just opened my eyes. So I remember when I did my interview, and this is a few years after 9/11, right? And it's, yeah, because I think my interview was like in 2003, late 2003, maybe. And so I go to headquarters. Back then they had the interview actually in headquarters. So I'm, you know, driving up first time, going there, going in, walking over the seal, the CIA seal, like all of that, right? And I had a couple of interviews with two different offices. And one office, and I think this guy was great because I went one office and I went like up to their office in some room and it was like very bland. You didn't really see anything. The other guy who interviewed me, he took me down to the cafeteria and he was like, hey, let's get some coffee. Let's talk. And he's giving me like just an interview, but over coffee and lunch or whatever. And I'm sitting in the cafeteria and then I think we're walking back to like, you know, walking to another room or whatever. And I actually see a woman wearing a headscarf, a Muslim woman walking through the halls. And I'm in the CIA. I'm like, wait, where am I? Is this really the CIA? And this is like a few years after 9/11. So that's just an example. And even though, you know, I'll point to maybe some, you know, some problems I had, there are Muslims there working in the counterterrorism fight and in other areas. Just because you're Muslim, it doesn't mean you have to work counterterrorism. But the thing I would say, because I don't want to leave the agency off the hook, because in the intel community, because you were saying like you would think they'd be recruiting more left and right. Yes, but I did find this one thing where, because religion is such a like. Just for America in general, right? It's a sensitive topic. And in government, especially, people don't talk about religion. So I would find that sometimes people would be bashful. Like people, you would think people would say, hey, you know, can I get your thought on this? Because it wasn't really that as much. It was more like you have to kind of put yourself in the position to be like, you know what? I kind of know something about this. And then maybe people would listen. But people aren't, you know, people kind of want to be experts sometimes and they're a little bashful about reaching out.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. You mentioned in your podcast, which we'll talk about here in a moment, that the Bureau and the CIA they have a rivalry, right? Mm. And I mean, from a common sense perspective, I think everyone goes, yeah, that would make sense. But can you actually lay out the differences for people who may not know, like they just know FBI, CIA, cool three-letter agencies with people doing stuff to protect us. What's really the difference and why is there this rivalry and how do you get in each other's way?
So there's different dimensions because, so the thing is probably every agency has some rivalry with like other agencies. Mm-hmm. That's the thing about government. Unfortunately, it's like when you're in an agency, it's like, you're the agency, it's your agency. And everyone just, you know, they do things incorrectly or they get things wrong. In CIA, so I was an analyst, which meant I was writing papers, doing analysis, briefing people. But you also are always interacting because when you write something, depending on the topic, right, you are coordinating, that's the term we use, with other agencies. So you'll write something and then you'll send it over to the FBI and their experts who are experts on that issue would comment, et cetera, et cetera. So we're always interacting. And you would find that at the CIA, they're always like, oh yeah, that agency, DOD, Department of Defense, oh, you know, they don't really know X, Y, Z. So you have this sort of tribalism, unfortunately, within our government. So that's like that, you have that in general. For analysts, the difference with FBI and CIA, I mean, there's the functional difference, which is FBI is a law enforcement agency, which is doing cases, investigating here in the United States. That is their mission, right? Defending the U.S. and their law enforcement. CIA is a different animal. CIA, you know, is doing intelligence collection on foreign targets, not on the United States, on foreign targets, foreign groups, etc. Not to arrest people. CIA people don't have badges that are arresting people, right? So CIA is collecting and providing, doing that collection, then providing that analysis. The analysts at CIA, I think it's like it was a very high level of analysis because CIA analysis was very, you know, for decades was like the cream of the crop. Like the CIA was the main intel agency doing analysis. The FBI has always had more of an agent culture. Agents have guns and badges. And then back in the day, analysts at FBI were kind of like secretaries. You know, you've got the, you know, there's a great movie. You know, I'm really into movies. There's really a great movie, you know, back in like, it's maybe 20 years old, but there was the Get Smart movie. that came out, you know, like 15, 20 years ago. And I actually think that movie was good because it actually played on that, where like the FBI was like, it was this big agent, and he was like treated the FBI analyst like really poorly. And so that's a different culture, right? There's more an agent culture, where at CIA amongst the analysts, we have more of an analyst culture. So you're just going to have these differences, and then, you know, different agencies are just gonna beef, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I actually have a much less fancy intel background. I was a military intelligence officer in the Army. And so, you know, they used to talk about the intelligence community, you know, and that included different agencies and different groups. And absolutely 100% people had prejudices against certain organizations, or you don't want to go CIA, you want to go FBI, you don't want to go FBI, you want to go CIA if you get a job, you know, after you get out. And so it's just funny to hear that that's totally 100% universal, and everyone has that, develops some sort of feeling about different agencies. Yeah. But you actually mentioned, going back a little bit, so you mentioned 1776 Unites and these couple of pieces that you wrote for them. What are you doing for what's your connection to 1776 Unites, and how did you fall into that post CIA?
So 1776, you know, in 2020, if I remember correctly, I wrote this piece going back to Summer of George Floyd, and I wrote this piece, and it's so funny. This gets into like the cultural angle more, right? Was because, you know, I remember, so Beyonce, let's talk about Beyonce if we can. I don't know if Beyonce has been mentioned on your podcast. So back in 2020, Beyonce came out with this video, this program special on Disney that was called Black is King. And I that seems like in 2023, it probably doesn't seem like a big deal. But when it happened, I was like, wait a second, that's not cool. That, like, Black is King? Like, what are we, like, first of all, and it's on Disney? Like, so I remember, like, in the 90s, you go, Black is King, right? Like, I mean, you had hip-hop songs, probably called Black is King. I used to write lyrics, and that would be like, Black is King, right? How is Disney doing this, like, to me, which seemed like Black idolatry, really, in my mind? And that's what I wrote. I wrote that Black is the new idol. So now we're like, here we are as a people who've come through all these struggles, and it was really our scripture and our religion. It was, you know, if you think of all the movements, right, especially the Christian faith, most of our leaders came through that experience with a strong scriptural base to fight the fight. It wasn't about, oh, we're Black, and because we're Black, you know, that was not what really, you know, that, you know, shaped much of our struggle. And so for us to be at this stage where we're like glamorizing Blackness, to me, it just seemed odd. And so I wrote this piece, and I was really looking for a place to pitch and to publish it. And I think I just reached out to 1776. I think they had just started in 2020. And I wrote that piece. And then I think several months or a year later, I wrote a piece about patriotism, African-American patriotism. So, so I've been a 1776 Unites scholar and have contributed to the Red, White, and Black series, the edited book that they've had, you know, a bunch of, you know, other great folks who've contributed to that. I was able to have my piece in that book.
And what does it mean actually to be like a scholar for them? Like you're editing, you're writing, you're doing research, you're like, what does that title mean?
I'm not sure how much. I mean, that may be more for a question for the Woodson Center, which has sort of developed it.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I think the way I saw it was more like, you know, they wanted to have a sort of an association of people who they either see as thought leaders or people really doing interesting things to draw on. Because when 1776 started, Unites started, it was really a reaction to the 1619 project. And 1619, you know, has its scholars and, you know, has its voices. Air quotes there.
I did air quotes. Yes. Scholars.
Yeah, right. It had its influence. It had, you know, its thought leaders and writers and journalists. So I think they wanted to assemble people that could you know, have a very different view and narrative, one that was less based on victimization, victimhood, one that saw America as a place of that we should embrace and see the sort of multidimensional history of America, not it being this, you know, just slavery, you know, it's just, you know, and it's mm-hmm. just, you know, almost this defeatist attitude. So I think it's an assembly of people that that they want to draw on. And I was real happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And those two pieces that you wrote are also wonderful. And I think all these things, all the components of Yaya come together in your podcast, mm-hmm. which is the Jabari Lincoln Files. This is your spy thriller podcast. I've listened to a couple episodes. Mm-hmm. I haven't listened to them all, okay. So I want to be honest about that. But it is so well produced. Obviously, people can tell listening to this that you have a great voice. So that's like... Oh, you know, it's you're the perfect person to read it and perform it, because I know it's a performance. It's not just reading it. And honestly, the podcasts that I listen to are really like this one that I'm on right now. I tend to just listen to people talking, long form, kind of boring. I don't listen to entertainment podcasts. I never had listened to an entertainment podcast till I had to prep for this one. And so I listen to yours. My husband does all that stuff. So he would be, I told him to listen to it. And I was like, you tell me what you think. So I don't want to. Some people who listen to my take on this might be like, well, that's how a lot of them are. But I thought it was very well produced. I thought it was so fun that it's kind of from the, like, I'm the analyst, you know, and I'm getting these data drops every week. It's, you know, that's when the episode publishes. And I thought that was really fun. It actually brought me back to, like, being a kid and playing Carmen Sandiego on the computer. I was like, oh, it's like Carmen Sandiego, but for adults. And I asked my husband, I was like, do they tend to, is this kind of a normal format to kind of put you like you're in the player seat? And he was like, nah, not so much, kind of, not really, you know. Yeah. So I know it is, after talking to him, it is a little bit more unique. And I thought that was a lot of fun. I want to read the synopsis here for our audience. It's a fictional audio thriller. Jabari Lincoln is the CIA's top financial intelligence analyst. He also happens to be an African-American Muslim. Born and raised in Detroit, he rises to the top of the intelligence game when he is unfairly suspected of being disloyal to the United States. Under a cloud of suspicion, he uncovers a mysterious cyber plot emerging in the Nigerian banking system. As a new financial weapon threatens the United States and the world, he travels across three continents to figure out who is pulling the strings as hidden forces try to eliminate him. Mm-hmm. And Yaya, I gotta ask, is this just your life story? Did you secretly save the world? Is that how this is going to end?
No. I always, the way I say it is a truly fictional podcast, truly fictional story with some very real elements. So there's some realistic stuff in there. Hopefully, you know, ripped, not from, you know, not, you know, there's some things from my experience or things I've observed that I've sort of, you know, sprinkled in there to make it realistic. But it's, yeah, no, it's a fictional story. I totally, you know, the plot and everything. Although the funny thing is, I mean, I can't really, we won't be able to talk too much about this because of spoilers, but there are some things that interestingly I wrote in the story and then later happened. And maybe I'll share one, which is not a big spoiler, especially if you finish, it's in episode 2, and I don't think this is a big spoiler, but so there's this one scene where in the story, Jabari Lincoln goes to Nigeria and he briefs the Central Bank of Nigeria. That's a part of, it's a main part of what happens in the early part of the story. And so, and you know, some stuff happens. I mean, it's like a really interesting thing, but him going to Nigeria to brief the Central Bank of Nigeria, like that's a main part of the story. And so I wrote this like in, you know, I started writing it in 2019. But lo and behold, at one point, a couple of years ago, and this was like 2021 or 2022, I forget. I got an email asking me to present briefing for the Central Bank of Nigeria, literally. And I was like, whoa, wait a second, what's going on here? So that actually happened. Now I ended up doing it remotely, but yeah, stuff like that happened in the story.
So what's the creative like writing process for this? I'm curious because I'm a creative person. I have a novel I'd like to write. I have a romantic comedy. I'm not even a romantic comedy fan, but one day this idea for romantic comedy came to my head and I was like, this isn't a book. This is a movie. Like if I write this down, it has to be a script, but I've never thought about doing kind of an entertainment style podcast. Did you know that when you were thinking of the story, that's what it was going to be? How did you know that? Or did, were you thinking a novel first, or how did that process even work?
So there's a lot of background because I had toyed with this format of a story, which is narrated in a podcast with sound design, like music, you know, in it. So that's the format of this podcast. So I actually had toyed with that a few years earlier. I created a podcast. It's actually still up. It's called Rhythm of Wisdom. And that podcast is somewhat similar, but it's true. So it's actually me. It's I started writing these little vignettes about my life, reflections, and I put it in a very dramatic tone, little stories. And I produced that, you know, years ago, that was like in 2015. And so those stories are already there. What had changed, where this podcast, the Jabari Lincoln Files, came from, was I was actually planning to write a memoir. And I sort of chuckle now, because I'm like, you know, it's a bit narcissistic. You know, everyone thinks they've got a memoir, you know. So that was me. I admit, like a few years. So I had been, I mean, I was like, people would love to read this story, you know. And so anyway, so I had this idea of writing a memoir, and I had a book proposal. And what I was trying to do was I was trying to get a literary agent, you know. So I had a book proposal, and I actually pitched it. And I had, I actually got a few rejections. I got about two or three rejections early on. You know, the literary agent said, "Oh, you know, great, it's a great story, but yeah, I can't take this on. I don't think, yeah, I'm going to pass." Which I think is just natural, right? You're trying to, you know, you're shopping stuff around. And I had this one experience where I went to this podcast conference in Philly that Audible had put together. And they had a pitch competition where they wanted people to pitch stories that could be on Audible. And I did it. And I actually did, I think, pretty well. Audible wanted to talk to me. They were like, "Oh my goodness, we want to," I felt like, you know, "Oh, I'm going to get signed." Like they were like, "Oh, we want to talk to you. We want to produce something." Then stuff happened. They had changed their format and it just like fell through. Like they were no longer, they ghosted me because they had had some programming change around, you know, at the time. So I was disappointed. Yeah. And at that point I was like, you know what? I don't know where it came from. I just said, you know what? Forget this. Actually doing a memoir, that's going to get personal, my personal, like, you know what? Why don't I just create something totally new and have fun with it? So I just decided to create a story, to create a character, make it a spy thriller. And I just had fun with it. And then I just started over about a year and a half, almost 2 years. I just started writing the chapters over nights and weekends.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you say you wrote, like, each episode is sort of like a chapter then? Is that how you sort of think of it? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So it's funny because it is written somewhat as a novel, but I wrote it knowing I was going to read it. So it's not like an audiobook. Like, people think like, "Oh, is it an audiobook?" And no, it's not an audiobook.
No,
it
it's
is
not. Like it's not.
Yeah, it's like this, hopefully this immersive, like dramatic storytelling experience. So I wrote it knowing, okay, this chapter is going to be probably one episode. Well, some of them were long, so I, you know, split them in two. But I wrote them as for the ear, really, as I was writing it.
How did you learn the actual production part?
So I just playing around. So I creatively, back in college, I was a radio programmer, radio DJ at Berkeley's radio station. So that was actually the highlight, one of the highlights of my college career. So I was always, and this was in the, you know, I was a hip hop DJ, not mixing and scratching, but selecting things to play in it. My show was like Friday nights. So I was always playing with music production and also narrating, you know, speaking over instrumentals.
Right.
So I had that. And so all I did was basically use some basic editing software or music software and to create the soundscape. I just, you know, self-taught. I mean, just pretty, you know, DIY, do it yourself. And with my first podcast, The Rhythm of Wisdom, I was doing those episodes. So I would create the music mostly. Usually I would create the music first and then I would write while I had the music playing on repeat. So the music is sort of setting the tone. That background music is setting the tone and then I'm writing it. So it's more than just writing. It's kind of like composing in a sense, because you're writing to a certain mood that's playing.
And maybe this is a silly question because maybe there's just too much variation, but how much time do you say it takes to produce one episode?
Oh man, that's why season two isn't out yet. So if you go from beginning to end, like the writing, I would say it takes like a month if I were to like, well, so when I was, so here's a good example. When I was doing the old podcast, I wrote episode by episode. When I did Jabari Lincoln Files, I wrote the whole thing, all the chapters at, you know, over, like I said, a year and a half. Yeah. So that was a long process. And then the next year and a half was, you know, doing more editing and then doing the music and then production, then recording. So essentially that was a 3-year project. I hope season 2 doesn't take that long because this was my first time. But I would say, yeah, if I were just writing an episode, yeah, it would probably take me a couple weeks to write, edit, and then record. Yeah, it would probably be like a month-long process for you know, 4 to 6 weeks for one episode, I think, depending on how much time I have.
Is it really hard to, I mean, have you developed a sort of fan base or followership? Do people often do this with some kind of like network backing almost? But you're on your own completely, right?
Yeah, so how does that work? A labor of love. So so this is what I'll say. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be giving up my stats, you know, or maybe it's good for me. Cause I remember when I started, you know, I said, you know what, if I had like 1,000 people that just real loyal listener, I would be happy, you know, like 1,000 people who were, that has been the case. I mean, in terms of my listenership, each episode over time, I mean, it's been out for several months now. I mean, I started in January and the season ended in March for season 1. So it's had, you know, organically, because I didn't do a lot of marketing. So I would look at these numbers like, oh, wow, 100 people, you know, a couple hundred people every week are downloading. So that has been good, just organically, and different types of people. Like some people reached out to me on Twitter, just like some random person, and they're like, wow, you know, I'm a lawyer, and yeah, I love this stuff, and I love
how do they find ideas. It? How do they find it? Just searching, you know, podcasts?
I think at least in my experience, there must have been a very good, you know, suggestion feature in. I think when it came out, it was being suggested like on Apple Podcasts, because that's the only thing I can think. And I did do a couple of interviews, so hopefully, actually, me being here is going to increase those numbers.
Because
because I was on a couple of podcasts, like I was on some spy podcasts and national security podcasts early on, and then I saw some people say, "Oh wow, I heard you on such and such podcast. I'm so glad that I listened to this." So just very very organically.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I'm always curious because, like I said, I have some of these creative ideas. I'm sure a lot of our audience does. And you're like, how much effort can I put into something that's a labor of love if it doesn't really, you know, if you put years into this and then 20 people listen to it, it's like, you know? Well, so I'm always curious as to how
people you know what?
Gain an audience.
But you know what? I mean, I think also just, so if you do, I encourage you to do it. To write something. One thing that may help is getting feedback. You know, I mean, I guess you would probably do that anyway, but I did that. I mean, I wrote and then I had like my network of people. I mean, it was kind of family and friends, but it was like people who were reading the first drafts, who gave me, you know, feedback. And then so many different things evolved because I reached out to a consultant to help look at my story, and he gave me great feedback. This guy named Cameron Pasha, I got to give him a shout out, and also a woman named Sahara Vora. Like they actually are, you know, people that do this stuff for a living. So they gave me great feedback and it helped me, I think, improve the story. I changed elements, like Jabari's wife. It's so interesting. I mean, it's weird because she's not like the main part of the story, but she's a significant part of the story. Mm-hmm. And that was based on feedback, like, you know, to sort of elevate her role from how she first started. So that's based on feedback. So I think whatever you do, just, like build a network of people to give you feedback.
Why the name Jabari Lincoln? I have to think there's a reason why his last name is Lincoln, when maybe Jabari too. I mean, he's a Muslim guy, so like you understand why his name's Jabari, but does Jabari, what does it mean? Like, how much thought did you put into just his name?
Very little. Very little. And actually it's not as grand as people would think.
Okay.
Although I like the name, I think I'm going to build off of that a little bit in season 2, like the origin of his name, like in his universe. But for me, I actually came up with the name like 20 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, so you're getting like the all the reveals, because here's something I've never revealed. So the name Jabari Lincoln. So I mentioned briefly in my bio, I taught for 3 years in between like grad school and before I joined the CIA. I was actually a math teacher at a DC charter high school in the early 2000s. And that experience was the toughest job I ever had. Teaching was just, it was great in so many ways, but it was such a tough job. And when I left teaching, I wrote, this was just to friends, kind of like how you're saying, I wrote an email story about this fake teacher who was teaching and all these funny experiences he had in the classroom, which were all real. And I sent them to my, you know how it is like in teaching, like we all commiserate, like teachers always commiserate about, you know, the administration, the students. So I had this net. So I sent all these like chapters to my former coworkers. And I had to come up with a name for the teacher. And it wasn't going to be Yahya Finoussi. It was Jabari Lincoln. And Jabari, honestly, I don't know where I got Jabari from, but Lincoln, I think at the time I was really into these crime novels, these mystery thrillers by a guy named, Jeffrey Deaver. And he's the guy that wrote, if you ever saw the movie with Denzel years ago, it was called The Bone Collector. It was like a 90s mystery thriller with Angelina Jolie. And that was, The Bone Collector was a Jeffrey Deaver novel. And the main protagonist, the detective, he's a quadriplegic. His name is Lincoln Rhyme. And I was really into those books. I liked it. Lincoln Rhyme was kind of like, you know, like a guy I liked. And I liked the writing, the mystery. And so I think that influenced me choosing Lincoln.
Okay. Yeah, that's some good behind the scenes. Listen
to season two. You may find out more about the origin of his name, like in the actual universe of the story.
Okay, yeah. I don't know why, but I'm very interested in that. And I love when the authors put a lot of thought into the names, and that the names have different meanings, or it's like, it's named after my grandma who was a nurse during World War II. And this character's a nurse. So that's why, you know, I love whether it's like literally the meaning of the name means strength or something. And so it was a strong character, or if it's a personal connection, I don't know. I'm just fascinated by
how, but you know, the other side of this, sorry to interrupt, but you do have to be careful. Cause I kind of thought like that, like, how do I get the names of these people? But you have to be careful, because if you name someone, if they're alive, then people are going to be like, oh, what are you saying about me? You know, is that? And I have to try to distance myself so people don't think like, you know, the wife of Jabari Lincoln is my wife. And, you know, this friend is that. Like, I don't want people to make those associations, because it's a story. It's not
right,
pseudonym necessarily.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point too. So I have a question for you before we wrap it up with the quick fire questions. That's kind of just a general thought that I've had listening to your podcast and just given your background. You've proudly served the country. Like I said, I've also served in the military, but I am kind of afraid of our government. I know that there's a lot of incompetencies, so I'm not really a conspiracy theorist person, because it takes a lot of coordination to execute on a lot of these conspiracies that are floating around. And I just know from my experience, like, that the government cannot pull that off. But I look at, you know, I look at what happened during COVID. I look at how our cousins in Canada went after people's bank accounts. And then I'm listening to your story, and even just the I know it's fictional, but the Jabari, I don't know if he's framed yet. I don't know like how this all came about, but I'm assuming there's some kind of framing or just government incompetency where your life is ruined. Some of my colleagues have already been canceled for bad opinions, not by the government, but, you know, they work for universities or Fortune 500 companies that are intertwined with the government, right? Like most of these institutions that are canceling people, they might be in the private sector, but like Amazon is not totally private. We all know they're deeply intertwined. Boeing is deeply intertwined with the government. There's all these connections. Yeah. And so am I going a little crazy to be sort of afraid and weary of like this overarching government that could just come in and ruin someone's life potentially? And I think it might get worse. Can you comfort me, or am I on to something?
Well, I mean, I think your initial like sort of caveat is good, right? Where you're saying like, you know, it would be very hard for our government to like really be very sophisticated with a conspiracy, and just because, you know, it just doesn't work that way. So I would agree with that. I would say that much of the government is just so bureaucratic, and that a lot of things that happen, bad things do happen. Mistakes do happen. I think a lot of it sometimes is just because you've got this bureaucracy that's not very feeling, that's not really, that just runs on automatic. And so a lot of, you know, a lot of what happens is just the fact that we have such a huge bureaucracy. I would say I've been out for so long, so like it's hard for me to comment on like what the government is doing now, right? I'm not mm-hmm. in government. I mean, right, I'm in right. I'm in the DC area, but I'm not in a government employee, so I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. But yeah. I will say that actually, honestly, over a lot of what's happened with me over the years is I've been looking at history and I've been looking at where technology is going. One of my research areas is what governments are doing with creating digital currency or central mm-hmm. bank digital currency, where we're going in terms of data collection, data analysis, big data, AI. And one observation that I have, it to me, I actually think that we're in a moment similar to where we were at the founding of this country, where if we think about our history, the founders, they were students of history, they were students of government, and they saw that the end result of governments having power tended to be absolutism, tended to be oppression, persecuting individuals. They saw that because it was just written in history. It was, you know, there mm-hmm. there was no question, they had observed that, and they created a framework that would limit the government, that would keep it, mm-hmm. that would have the individual, you know, have undeniable rights and or inalienable rights, and have, you know, the Fourth Amendment keep, you know, you from unreasonable search and seizure, because of what they had seen, that the government automatically just imposes itself. And so we have been fortunate in this country to have a system which has grown and we've sort of taken for granted. Why do I think we're in a similar point now? Because of technology. And mm-hmm. what I'm seeing now, not in government, is that technology is getting, we're interacting with technology so much that data is becoming, you know, ubiquitous, and data, we're emanating more data in just our daily lives. And there are now new mechanisms just to collect data no matter what. I mean, even if you just think the stuff you don't think about, like if your car was stolen or carjacked, you know, God forbid, you're, you know, something like that happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, the police is, you know, they have a lot of tools to see where that license plate, you know, has gone. Like they're probably going to find that car in a regular, you know, regular city in America because of the amount of surveillance that exists, right? And those mm-hmm. are like, if your car is stolen, you're like, oh, that's great, I got my car back. You know, they just looked at the records and they saw the license plate, blah, 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 right? That mm-hmm. stuff exists. We are moving towards a point where the government is going to be able to have, or there are going to be ways to have much more data on individuals. And I think the technology is advancing ahead of our understanding of, well, how do we keep that from getting for government to have everything? That's what mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I'm seeing. And in a lot of my work is thinking about this issue and this concern, because I think a lot of people, I mean, I talk to people and you know, you talk to people, some people are like, yeah, but who cares if the government has this, you know, who cares if the government knows it? And I almost think like, what, have you not studied history? I think people just assume like, oh, well, government has always been benevolent. Yeah.
And again, have you seen Enemy of the State? Come on.
You know, and it's funny because people say, well, conspiracy theories, conspiracy. And the thing is, like, yes, there are conspiracy theories, and the government is not as, the thing is, when you start feeding the beast gets bigger and bigger. The beast wants more and more. And you can get to a point where if people don't push back, you know, you can get to the point where you are in this sort of absolutist sense. Now we're not going to have a dictator. Hopefully we're not going to have some, you know, a monarchy. I don't think we're on the road there, but we are, you know, we're getting into a world where we may not have, you may not be able to get into a place where there is not some record of your activity that is available. And that's a very, like, again, it's not conspiracy theory. It's just like, this is kind of the trend. How do I know? Look at the Chinese version, the CCP mm-hmm. version of this, is they are very clear that they want a digitized world. And for them, there's no idea of like individual rights or that you have individual mm-hmm. privacy. You know, for them, the data belongs to the state, your data belongs to the state, and they're going to build for efficiency, for delivering services, for management, for anti-money laundering, for criminal stuff. They're building ways to integrate data and have it all, you know, have like a all of the data that they, that the state needs. So I see what's happening in China. And if you don't have any framework to protect yourself from that, the government will be all consuming. So that is a concern. I'm trying not to be a conspiracy theorist, but you're not off there on the concern. And I actually support like that pushback, because if we don't have that, it's not going to end well.
So do I need to, everybody needs to throw out their smartphones, don't have Alexa in the house, buy gold bars and bury them in the backyard? Like, what do I need to be doing, Yaya? Save me.
You know what? I will say, I know you're joking, but not joking. I will say, and I know we're going to wrap up, but I will say that, you know, how I think of this, I think like, there's no way I could tell people, like no one's going to tell you to, you know, not be online, not use a smartphone. Like, it just doesn't work, right? We've just, the point of no return. So there's no legislation. I don't think we can like get people to be more, you know, not virtual or anything like that. But I do think, at least I've sort of personally come to this idea, that I think the answer is we have to find out a way, we have to find ways to do things non-digitally in the real, like you have to, I think in your life, do things that keep you connected to the real, connected to the mm-hmm. physical. I mean, again, I know you're a religious person. I know you're a Christian, faithful Christian, mm-hmm. biblical worldview. You know, creation, right, comes from God. So mm-hmm. if we are always operating, so when you're interacting with creation, you're working, at least my understanding is, you're interacting with God's signs, right? His signs are in creation. So you're outdoors, when you're interacting with people, that's God's creation. Now, everything that we create, human beings, is not God's creation. It might be good, right? We might design a good building. We might design a good car. We might design this, an app. These are all things that we're creating. So if we're only interacting with the things that we're creating, we're removed from God's creation and God's signs. So if I would say anything, it's like, I think there's something there in that we can't go all digital. We can't go all virtual, because if we do, we're being cut from the source that our creator has given to us. So, yeah.
You can put that on a t-shirt. I like that a lot. Thank you for that. That is a great point to end and go into our 10 speed round questions. Uh-oh. Are you ready for them?
No, but I have no choice.
Okay. Number one. What is your least favorite color?
Orange.
That's my favorite color.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's it. This episode's over. No, I'm just kidding. Where is there systemic racism in America?
In the fact that there's this expectation that Black folks need special help and can't do things by competing with their non-Black peers.
What is the tastiest style of cheese?
Pepper jack.
The Black Panther or Blade?
I'm going to lose all my nerd cred. I don't think I saw Blade. In the 90s, it was hit or miss for me, especially the college years. I missed a lot of movies. So Black Panther, because I haven't seen Blade.
Fair enough. Yeah. Is the word Negro a slur?
No es una palabra en español. It's a word in Spanish. It's not a slur. Negro is not a slur. I mean, but you got to, you know, use it appropriately, I guess.
Yeah. Someone else gave a similar answer to that question. What is your favorite movie with a Black lead?
With a Black lead? I guess I'll just go with my old school, like back in the day, Do the Right Thing, because it was such a big influence on me.
Yep. Do you think BET still serves a worthwhile purpose?
No.
Should the election day be made a national holiday?
I haven't thought much about it, but I will say no.
What is your favorite cartoon movie?
Cartoon movie would be tie between Finding Nemo and Monster Inc.
Those are two of my favorite twos. My daughter's three, and she just watched Finding Nemo for the first time, and I was like on the edge of my seat, just like hoping she would have a good reaction to it.
Exactly. Yep.
And your final question, what is the, speaking of conspiracy theories, what's the wildest conspiracy theory you low-key believe is true?
That's a good one, and it's a tough one. So do I believe in any on that I know the time is ticking. Tick tock.
No, it's okay. TikTok. Take your time. Or maybe you don't have one. Maybe you're just not a conspiracy guy.
Yeah, I'm not a conspiracy. It's so hard. Oh, I didn't tell you my conspiracy theory story, and we're at the end.
We got time.
I think so. I'm gonna say none, and I will. Can I explain why?
Yeah. Yes. Please.
Okay. So here I have a story about conspiracy theories and why I don't believe in them. Because when I was a teenager in my Afrocentric Black nationalist mindset, I did. Mm-hmm. I'm going to name drop here. Like, some people who know this name will be like, I can't believe this guy's mentioned this guy. So I'm sure kind of you've never heard of this guy, or maybe you have. But so in my high school days and early college days, I would sometimes listen to these tapes by this guy named Steve Coakley. So if people that were in like the sort of Black Afrocentric movement will know this. Steve Coakley was a guy who talked a lot about the Trilateral Commission, conspiracy theories, blah, blah. He's African-American guy. And he was, back in the day, there's like tapes and stuff. So he had this one conspiracy theory. He came to the Bay Area, and this is when I was in college. And he came to the Bay Area, and he had this speech about something called the boule. Have you ever heard of the boule?
Mm-mm.
So the boule, in his theory, was this secret organization, a fraternity of African-American men. It's kind of like the Black Skull and Bones, according to him.
Okay.
And so it was basically pulling the strings for Black society, and it was the reason why Black people were down, because they were like in cahoots with the white man to bring, like, to make sure Blacks were subservient, and while they could get the crumbs, like, that was basically the story.
Yeah.
And so he gave this speech. I went to this speech, and he said he found the list of the Boule members that were in the Bay Area. So he reads through the names, and these are real people. One person next to him is like, oh my goodness, I know that person. I can't believe he's a member of the Boule. Oh my goodness. Okay. Time goes by, maybe even a year. So I remember that someone at UC Berkeley, who was a high administrator, African-American, was named as a member of the Boule. And so to end the story, basically, a year, time goes by, and I'm in this student organization, and we're trying to raise money. We're doing a fundraiser to do this trip to the city. And someone says, oh, we should go talk to this administrator because he's African-American. He's going to help us raise the funds, blah, blah, blah. So it's this guy who I know was named as a member of the Boule. So here I am, this young college student. I'm like, oh my goodness. Oh, I'm going behind enemy lines. This guy's like, ooh, this, blah, blah, blah. And so we go, and we, our student organization, we're talking about, this conference we're going to, blah, blah, blah. And so then he immediately, he tells us, this is great. Looking at your proposal. Yeah, let me do what I can. I'm a part of this graduate fraternity called blah, blah, blah. I forget the name of it. It is an actual thing. It's an actual fraternity of graduate African-American men. I think the slang name is Boule. And he's like, yeah, I'll take it to them. And yeah, maybe we'll definitely provide some money, blah, blah. So nonchalant. And I was like, wait a second. I thought it was a secret organization. Like, how did he, this is my just naivete, And so that was the first lesson. And then later I heard Steve Coakley talk about, like, his things are conspiracy theories. Like, they're just theories. I heard years later on the radio. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was the experience of like thinking about a conspiracy theory, actually getting close to it, and then just realizing it was just bunk.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, no, never again. Fool me
never
once.
Never again. Yeah, fool
shame
me
on me. Exactly. Shame on you. Shame on me twice. What did Bush say? I don't even know.
Yeah. Sorry for that long-winded. Yeah. But that's why.
No, that's great. It's wonderful. Do you have any, that was kind of a final thought, but do you have anything else that you want to plug, thought you want to finish, anything else you want to get off your chest, Jabari Lincoln stuff? When is that next season dropping, or when maybe an estimate of when it's coming out?
Wow.
Anything else you want to leave us with?
I will just leave the listeners who are listening to this and they're like, why should I listen to this? What is this podcast he's talking about? Just give me a chance. Just check out, there's even a teaser. There's, you know, mm-hmm. just check out episode one. See if it grabs you. If it doesn't grab you, it doesn't. But please go find the Jabari Lincoln Files wherever you get your podcast. Give it a listen. And that would make me so happy.
Do you have we'll link to, I know there's a website for Jabari Lincoln, right? And then can people, you have a subscriber list or something too, right?
So yeah, I probably need to be better at managing
email list.
Yeah. So there is a way there's like a subscribe where I can reach out. So if you go to JabariLincoln.com, you can find it there and you could put in your email and then be informed when we're getting ready for season two.
Okay. Awesome. Well, Yaya, thanks for coming on. Thank you for being a friend of Free Black Thought, Free African American Thought.
FAAT doesn't sound, it's not as cool. So, no,
yeah, it doesn't roll off the tongue as good.
FBT, Free Black Thought, it's all good.
Yes, thank you for coming on.
Although, my question for you is, free a verb or like an adjective?
Adjective? It's, well, we like the name because it's both. So it's we leave it up to interpretation. I think everyone thinks of it as a verb or an adjective first. Like for everybody, it's different how they read it.
Right. Okay.
For me, I read it as an adjective first.
Yeah.
Right. That's how I read it. But other people read it and we like to leave it a little bit nuanced there. So that's a great question. We'll keep in touch. I know that you'll probably come on the podcast, hopefully again, maybe after season two, or maybe after you write some more cool, you know, pieces for 1776 Unites or other places. We love having you as we would consider, I think, a colleague here. So thank you so much, Yaya, and I'll see you around.
Thank you, Connie. Take care.
The number you have dialed.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.